Welcome to the Why Isn't It Working? Business and Tech Podcast, talking all things business and tech in the emerging and enterprise space. Here are your hosts, Carl Wood and Michael Hamilton.
All right, welcome to the podcast. As with me, as always, is Michael Hamilton. Michael, how are you today?
Oh, very good, Carl. Thank you. Very good.
Excellent. And lovely to see you got a haircut as per usual. Joining us today, we're very happy to have Peter Drum. Peter is the CEO of Idea Science, a specialized consulting firm that works specifically around the CRM and marketing components within Salesforce and other providers. They're based in Sydney, Adelaide, and they have a huge amount of staff and a huge amount of experience in this area. So we're very, very happy to have Peter here as a very forward-thinking individual. So Peter, thank you very much and welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you very much, Carl. Really appreciate you having me.
Awesome. Michael, I'll hand it over to yourself to begin.
Thank you, Carl. So Peter, tell us about your journey, your career, and you know what interests you. That's what we want to know about today.
Very good. What interests me? Let's start with a little bit about the journey. So I was trained as an engineer, computer systems engineer originally. So I come from a bit of a technical background. I've filled consulting roles though, and then run consulting teams and then ultimately consulting businesses. And I've been doing the running businesses side for about 15 years now. I did some of that over in the States. So I've got quite a bit of exposure to the way that the business and systems and markets operate over there. And then the rest of it since the last 12 years have been down in Australia here. And we run, as I think Carl mentioned, you know, CRM, marketing and customer experience strategy programs of work out of here in Australia, and we serve customers in Australia, but also internationally through into Southeast Asia, into Europe, both North and South Europe, and into Latin America as well. So I've been doing quite a bit of that. What's interest me? This is an interesting one, interesting question in general. I didn't get my haircut, by the way. Sorry, Mike. But innovation and transforming stuff and in a nutshell, trying to disrupt things is probably what interests me, always has been. Not necessarily to the point of being a real troublemaker, but kind of close to it. So I like to think about things differently. I like to challenge our team to think about doing things differently. And being passionate about changing the status quo is what we do. So most of the work that we do with our customers is very much trying to think about what their forward vision is and how we can help them change.
That is fantastic. And so I know you like to spot the transformation subject. Businesses should transform. What do you mean by that? What's your focus when you say that?
The reality is that business is always transforming, of course, right? There's a continuous innovation or change cycle that every business gets confronted with. Since things have gone very global, then that the pace of that transformation and the forced transformation has increased all the time. In Australia, what we find, and this is probably quite topical now with a lot of the announcements around innovation and a dependency on foreign markets, foreign suppliers and supply chains and things like this, is that we very rapidly get faced with commoditization of the things that we're really good at. With the exception, and sometimes even with the inclusion of things like mining and those sorts of things, which are kind of difficult for people to commoditize because they don't have the stuff in the ground. The rest of the things that we do as a country, most of them are subject to, you know, penetration and disruption by other markets where the cost base is lower or the population is much higher or things like that. And we have to continue to look for new and different ways to do things. So that's probably the most interesting thing that's a force for that. Now, if you consider that, of course, then, you know, the real challenge we have is how do we keep on changing to be able to be relevant and succeed? And that's what I consider to be transforming.
Interesting.
Long-winded way of saying it, by the way, but hopefully.
No. There's many different descriptions we've come across with talking to people. But this week, there's been a bit of a media coverage in Australia around the Prime Minister's announcement, or not necessarily Prime Minister, but about how Australia should be an adopter of technology than an innovator or producer of it.
Yep.
What's your thoughts on that? I'm not sure if there's a right or wrong answer to it, but what do you think?
You might be able to anticipate this, of course, from me, but I completely disagree. Commoditization is what comes into play here, right? So if we're an adopter, then where is it that we actually provide value in this process? If our objective was to just be a net exporter of natural resources and be a very services-driven economy, then great, that would be a perfectly fine description of what we should be doing. But if we consider ourselves as a growth economy, a knowledge economy, all of the things that our politicians talk about all the time, and the reality of what we as people in business want to be able to achieve, then you just can't do that. You have to be an innovator. You can't adopt technology. You need to be able to drive it. Because technology is ultimately what drives most of the change in the way businesses operate and the way people and society operates. Many, many examples of that, of course, by the way. So a lot of what we've done, let me take a couple of examples recently. We've worked with automotive organizations, and obviously the world of automotive has drastically changed with the rise of things like the gig economy, transport as a service offerings. The early stages of that are things like on-demand transport, Uber. Uber Eats is a classic one that's taken off a lot in the pandemic at the moment, those sorts of things. But ultimately, as you look forward, some of the trials that are happening overseas where you pay a subscription service and you get access to multimodal transport, those things are all driven by technology. I pay a single fee in some European cities and I can get access to a bicycle, a car, a train, a bus, a ferry, all that sort of stuff. And I pay a little usage fee and all that sort of stuff. And I never own any of these modes of transport. So imagine if you're a retailer or a distributor of motor vehicles, this is a massive threat to your business model. Everything has to change. And you might say this is a long way away, but realistically, in the next 10 years, we're going to see a massive shift towards that.
Well, it's an interesting example because, if you look at it now, multiple automotive manufacturers are actually having to come together to economically produce a car for the market, as opposed to back in the day where everyone produced their own unique platforms and engine configurations, all those sort of things as well.
Yep.
So the rise of the subscription service, obviously, Peter, you and Idea Science are very, very heavily involved with Salesforce implementations. So that is one area, I guess, that sort of came completely out of left field and smashed the traditional CRM and offered more subscription-friendly service, SaaS offered and everything like that. So they're a very innovative company, very, very well respected. How have you found their adoption to the market in the APAC region? Do you work quite closely with them? Do they, is there anything coming down their pipeline that you're finding quite interesting as well?
Those are two kind of different questions, I think. how have we found their adoption? Interestingly enough, we probably trail somewhere between 2 to 5 years behind the US when it comes to adoption of things like subscription services, and Salesforce is one of the prime examples. So the things that tend to be really innovative in other markets tend to come here, quite a bit later. So a lot of that's, we've got a relatively conservative approach to adopting and innovating technology, very much to the quote that you had before of Mike around the direction that our government is espousing. That's very symptomatic of the way that we think as a whole in businesses in Australia. Some of that's a function of obviously the way businesses operate. A lot larger percentage or proportion of US-based businesses, for example, are funded by someone else's money, venture capital, private equity, and those sorts of funding models. So they're a little bit more free and easy in the way they make decisions around spending that money. Over here, it tends to be either owned by the shareholders or owned by the banks and those sorts of things, and a little bit more conservative. So there's some of those influences, but market size and things like that drives differences as well. So as a function of that, of course, though, if we're trailing behind what other innovative markets are doing, then we often end up in a copycat regime, except for little pockets of innovation. So I think that's probably what we've seen.
And a lot of those innovation pockets, again, seem to be migrating overseas as quickly as possible due to some of the reasons you've mentioned before, right? Whether it's a different access to funds and a different approach to risk. So how do we tread that happy medium path then, Peter? What's kind of the ideal situation? Should we be investing in our own here to launch overseas? Should the government be more heavily involved in potentially spring padding businesses to then get access to larger markets? Should we be encouraging people to retain their IP here? What do you think would be the best way to approach it?
Interestingly enough, I'm going to take a little bit of a tangent here. Even though I'm in a very digitally oriented business and role and industry, I still believe in the power of face-to-face communications and interacting with people personally. And because of that, I think that approaching the biggest markets in the world, and the reality is when it comes to technology, that's the US, approaching that requires direct presence in the States. So if you think about it, once you get to the point where you really want to scale and grow a business at a global level, then you have no choice but to land a presence over there. And you have a much, much more attractive kind of set of credentials and access to market if you have a headquarters over there versus just land a presence there. So the reality is, I think the natural growth path will end up having most of the biggest technology companies in the world based in the States. Having said that, what's the right path to get there? I think the best way we can do it is to make sure that we retain as much of that ownership and investment and equity in organizations as long as possible, which means giving them path to growth. So incentives that enable to, as you kind of described it, right, a springboard to be able to go international is something that is the minimum bar. But providing incentives so that, you know, a beneficial ownership base stays over here, and that's, you know, some of the core integration and innovation functions that come about are still domiciled over here, is what I would say is that should be the core premise of any strategy that we have to incent businesses here. And some of our businesses have done a really good job, and Atlassian has done a great job with that, for example. So now, if the really big success stories can do it, then we should be able to find a way to make that repeatable.
Very much so. And look, obviously there's different models and strategy. And I know we discussed in the past, Peter, was the what's in the national interest for Australia, for example, in innovation. So what sort of model do you reckon we should adopt? Should it stay at seeding in Series A and then go overseas? Or what should happen there? What's your opinion?
Well, like I said, I think taking it as far along the path as possible is the obvious thing to do. So if you stop at Series A funding, then chances are you're going to see this continual flight and a continual drain of skills and expertise overseas. So that's not the right path if you can avoid going down that path. And clearly we can, right, if we're going to spend the sorts of amounts of investment that we're going to spend at a government level trying to buy our way out of a pandemic right now, which, by the way, I think is a really good thing to do, then we can absolutely afford to take a future-facing view on something like incenting businesses and technology on businesses.
Not very much.
Take a different thinking and a very different line of conversation though, right? You can't be talking about adoption of technology when you're talking about that. It's got to be about innovation.
Do you think we're partially at fault here as well? Because from a technical standpoint, we don't have really a unionized body, so to speak, that kind of lobbies to the government in the same way that maybe, forestry, mining and those sort of traditional industries have, and they kind of wield a bit of power in that respect. So does there need to be a bit of unionization to sort of, change the wheels in government? Or do you think it can be done through leading by example and having companies, like you mentioned Atlassian, who are a shining beacon of what can be achieved with Aussie ingenuity?
I think there's a bit of both. Clearly, the really respected leaders, and Mike Cannon-Brookes has been very visible, obviously. They carry an enormous clout, and they're kind of our equivalent of a Bill Gates or someone like that, right? So people are clearly going to listen when you see a massive success story talking about particular issues outside of purely just policy things that are beneficial to them. So it's absolutely relevant. I don't think that's the only way to do it. Having industry bodies that lobby for you, whether they're union-centric ones or otherwise, is very valuable. We do have them, of course, right? We have Institute of Engineers, we have the Australian Computer Society and Information Industry Association and other bodies like that. We have quite a few of them. Do they have the sway that seems to be held internationally? Maybe not. Having said that, I think a lot of that sway actually comes from, money rather than lobbying power and bodies over in the States. So the reality is you've got a very, very wealthy technocrat sort of class over in the States, and they have a significant impact and influence over policy and regulation.
It's funny the US, doesn't matter what government's in, their innovation general run. Yeah. It's underneath the hood and it keeps running. What do you believe, is it more of a government influencing in Australia that we should grow innovation in the future? Or is there something else that should take it to do that? More private investment, more active? What do you reckon?
The reality is government investment doesn't drive a massive amount of activity in the States, right? So you're trying to replicate what some of the most successful models for innovation. You've got to be kind of cautious. Massive investments of government investment is questionable sometimes in terms of what the return is. Some of it's actually around the models that are available to businesses rather than necessarily the direct investment. So, for example, our R&D incentive regimes, they're somewhat attractive, but they're kind of restrictive as well. You have to obviously prove that it's genuinely R&D, Whereas there are other regimes internationally that really talk about the stage that a business is at rather than necessarily what their activity is when they provide incentives. So that's one example where you could obviously make a difference. But the other thing is, obviously, like I said before, the states, the vast majority of businesses are actually doing that innovation on someone else's dime, and it is not normally government. It's private equity, it's venture capital money, it's things like that. So providing a more conducive environment to do that is probably the most attractive thing. The interesting thing, of course, is that our market is comparatively, I don't want to say minuscule, but quite small. So we're an excellent incubator for businesses, but not so much a growth path. So I think going back to that conversation we had before, finding a way so that we can provide a springboard so businesses don't have to move overseas to be able to take that next step and access global markets is probably the key. We, in terms of things like, at least up until now, the focus of our tax policy and all that sort of stuff has very much been around compliance and getting the very large international multinational organizations to pay their share and things like that. Not so much about providing incentive models and things like that for our local businesses to be able to build and grow. Whereas the US is more than happy to kind of ignore the international affairs of their really big tech companies as long as they pay their domestic taxes. So quite a different approach, right?
Well, that's it. I mean, there's certain things. I think Austin, for example, Texas has now become a bit of a tech hub by providing incentives for companies to actually move head offices there by, abolishing any tax for the year that they would normally pay in regards to buildings, providing, free rental assistance and those sort of things as well, just to shift things from state to state. So I guess the main thing, like you mentioned though, Peter, is that as a smaller market, we can look at market-based problems, but they probably won't have the same impact as if you're looking at something like Europe or the States where you've got, in the hundreds of millions of potential customers as opposed to, 10 to 20 million here as well.
Yeah, we do a good job of adopting technology. Like I said before, in the corporate world, we're probably quite a bit delayed over where you find in the US and things like that. But in the consumer world, we're actually very rapid adopters of technology. So we're an excellent incubation market. We can prove the concept over here quite well. We've got a pretty stable, mature political system and social cohesion and things like that. So the risks associated with incubating a business here are relatively low. But you very quickly bump up against an upper size when it comes to market. So you have to look elsewhere. And your phenomenon you talked about before, the states competing for each other, having different taxation regimes and all that sort of stuff, our federal model doesn't really replicate that, right? So you can argue about whether that's a good or a bad thing, but the taxes and the states and so forth over in the US are a right royal mess when it comes to a lot of the regulations and trying to maintain them and all that sort of stuff. But they do provide a range of interesting competitive scenarios that help businesses maximize value.
Awesome.
You've got the mobility, yeah.
Are there any companies at the moment that you've kind of got your eye on within the Australian region that are doing any exciting things?
I think there are a lot. And this comes down to whether I'm really talking on behalf of the business that I'm running right now or my personal interest. I think Mike and I have had a talk about some of the things that I'm really interested in. So I'm very interested in the development of both energy policies and general environmentally friendly policies and the technology that drives that. So I'm particularly fascinated by any of the early stage kind of commercialization engines or vehicles behind hydrogen technology. I'm particularly interested in the next wave of agricultural technology that potentially means that we open up portions of Australia that are largely deserts right now, but aren't necessarily of that significant an ecological value that we shouldn't actually be able to make something useful out of them. Then there's a lot of Australia that fits in that category. So those sorts of things are the things that I'm really interested in. I could probably reel off a number of different early stage businesses that have ideas around that stuff. So that's what I'm interested in more than anything else. Yeah, our big picture leadership when it comes to climate and energy policies and things like that. You may have an opinion on that, but I don't think that we have a very coherent model. So I'm interested in what people are doing to get around that and try and innovate on their own.
Yep. No, it's kind of a case, I think you're right, of just acting and sort of asking for forgiveness after the fact. And if anything, what we've seen with the COVID-19 scenario, and again, people might have different opinion to me, but it sort of showcases the difference between states bickering and federal, and no one's got a clear and concise leadership on how it should have been handled from the start. So again, I think you're right. When it comes to energy, clean regulation, those things still have quite a bit way to go. And I think there are a lot of people who are passionate in the private sector who are probably looking to use technology to push that forward as well, so which is a good sign.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because the fact that we've still got portions of our federal government talking about, and I don't want to make this just a political conversation, by the way, but the fact that you've still got people talking about subsidising gas-fired or coal-fired power stations is kind of a sign of where our priorities are and are not. And that these are fascinating when you compare them to even some of the other very conservative-led countries around the world, which aren't talking about those things, even if they potentially still have some of those things in place.
Now, the environment's a huge one. And also, you mentioned agriculture also before. I noticed, I think Australia's GDP contribution is about $60 billion, I think, at the moment, the last time I looked, around that, give or take. Obviously, mining traditionally has been over $100 billion to the GDP. Now, I know agriculture is one of the big parts of Australia's growth for the next couple of decades, right, and expanding on that to do that. I know that the Dutch model's huge, right? They have about 94 or 100 billion euro dollars worth of GDP annually there. That's the size of Tasmania, basically, their footprint there. You mentioned the use of deserts, right, and unused land. We could plant greenhouses and just be a food bowl into Asia. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, this is probably the, you know, when you think about big thinking in Australia, and these things take obviously a long time to realise. They're well beyond a political cycle. You're probably talking, you know, 5, 10, 15 year investment cycles to realise value out of these things. But we absolutely could, and you combine it with, you know, things like solar energy or hydrogen power energy, which releases us to an extent from obviously the vagaries of sun and wind and those sorts of things, then those things aren't mutually exclusive, by the way. You can produce hydrogen from solar energy. So that you combine that and you land that in places like northwest of Australia, where we really don't have any population, have vast tracts of land that are actually being mined right now, so they're clearly not of that significant environmental value, because we're not treating them that way. So you've got immense opportunity to do that. And food security is a big thing for us locally, but it's a massive thing for Asia, where you've got billions of people, obviously, that need to be fed. So this is a huge opportunity for us.
And that also leads to the national interest, right? So with these problems, obviously water is so a big issue around the country, and obviously that part of it. We could actually just focus our national agenda on innovation in these areas and tell people to go and focus on these and fund it. Is that something that we should be doing better? Making it known?
I think you know the answer to that one. Clearly.
Yeah, exactly. I know I probably answered that before, but is that a model we should adopt?
All these things are future-facing, and that's the reality. We don't actually have a future-facing vision. What do we actually want to be doing? A lot of the things that I do and our team does with businesses is say, what's your big vision, right? What do you want to be in 10 years, 15 years time, when a lot of your current business model is either completely commoditized or it's disappeared? We don't actually do the same thing as a nation here. We rely on everybody as individuals and as corporations and things like that to kind of just figure it out as we go. But if you think about big picture resources, some of our biggest exports right now, things like coal and gas and so forth, they're going to be a diminishing portion of our national wealth. So what do we replace it with? What do we want to be? And a net exporter of something is obviously what we have to be. Net exporter of food and value-added products would be great. Net exporter of energy in a healthy, greenhouse-friendly way would be really good too, right? So those things, if you set out those big picture objectives and then you say all of our incentives and funding model need to align with those, then obviously you're going to choose some of those things you just talked about, Mike. So in my view, we should do that. I'm not pretending I'm going to go and run for politics and go and change this. So I'm probably going to stop at talking about it and lobbying for some people about it, yeah.
Fantastic. I guess to shift the conversation to the left a bit. So one of the big things at the moment the federal government's looking at as well is contact tracing. And obviously, I believe that Salesforce is being trialed at the moment for the implementation for that. Are you guys with Idea Science doing anything around that at the moment during the COVID period? Are you looking at anything around contact tracing and assisting in that area? Or is that something you guys haven't touched yet?
It's not something that we specifically had a lot of involvement with. We have actually been working with some of the Salesforce account executives who own some of those relationships. The Salesforce services team themselves have done some of that work and some of their other partners in areas where we don't actually work. Quite familiar with the approaches. And Salesforce at its heart is a great way to be able to aggregate things around relationships with customers and between customers. So it's a great platform to do this sort of stuff. And the, you know, the Internet of Things capabilities that they have are a natural fit to. So it's an obvious choice. There's been a pretty broad adoption in terms of a lot of services in particularly state governments on Salesforce platforms. And they've been really effective because, you know, as a lot of as a service offerings, they're quite easy to scale. And if you find a model that works, then adapting it to a similar service model but a slightly different problem tends to be much easier.
Fantastic. Some of the other work you guys do as well is, I guess, around the marketing campaign and automation as well and helping businesses. So talk to us about the range, you know, in regards to size. Obviously, you deal with quite a few on the enterprise side, but also on the small, medium. So has there been a big change recently that something like, you know, a Salesforce platform has given a lot of smaller customers who never had sort of the budgets or the capability to actually go out and spread their message about, you know, their products or their capabilities to a larger audience than before? Is that sort of even the playing field a bit between, you know, SMBs to enterprise?
It has and it hasn't. So it's clearly even the playing field in terms of accessibility. So as a business, I can utilize a marketing automation platform. It doesn't have to be Salesforce, of course, but that's the one that we largely work with. And you can communicate to customers at a scale you never could before. So if you've got enough customer details to go and deliver your message to, then you can do so. I think what you find, though, is there's a lot of fatigue with customers when it comes to receiving emails or SMSs or being prompted with ads online and those sorts of things. So where it hasn't necessarily even the playing field is the expertise required to make sure that your message gets through. So that's largely what we work with customers around, making sure that we deliver the right message at the right time, but also making sure that every communication you have has a purpose and has a desired action and is designed to be able to achieve that action. Now, that might seem really simple, but the reality is a lot of email marketing and to an extent other platform marketing has very much been a load and spray message. So you send a message as broadly as possible, create as big a coverage of as big an audience as possible, and we think we're doing a great job. The reality is that, you know, like I said, that fatigue when it comes to being marketed to kicks in pretty quickly, and you can reach a really big audience, but it may not deliver very big results. And it gets very expensive too, because a lot of the targeting models that targets, you know, social media platforms and so forth, every time someone clicks on something that's of interest to them, you get to pay a nice little fee over to Mr. Zuckerberg or someone like that. And you may or may not get any outcome from it. So getting intelligent and smart about how you actually communicate with customers so that it delivers the desired business outcome, not the desired immediate click, is something that's really valuable. That's what we do a lot of.
And is a lot of that data-driven? So trying to create, like, you know, a level of personalization that tailors the message to be more effective. So rather than sort of sending something en masse, so to speak, it's much more personalized for either your target audience or your target customer?
It's data-driven, it's experience-driven, and it is also, it's personalization-driven, experience-driven, and data-driven. So clearly making something personalized, making it relevant to somebody, and linking across all the different channels of communications and interactions makes it much more likely that someone's going to respond the way you'd like to be able to do. So, you know, let's imagine you're talking about some sort of retail scenario. If I'm browsing a website and then I subsequently have some sort of interaction that identifies me, then if I'm communicating to you, I really shouldn't just be communicating in a broad branded way with you. I should be talking to you about the specific areas of interest you have. That seems very, very logical and something that everybody should know, but it's not the way many organizations work. If you know, you'll end up on a mailing list of somebody and you'll end up receiving the same message as I would. And that you may have a completely different set of expectations or interests. You probably don't follow Richmond, so you've probably got something that you're interested in, right? These things, you know, they seem like simple things, but connecting experiences together, and that's where the experience element comes in, means that you deliver something that's relevant to somebody and they're more likely to react. And then when we talk about things that are data-driven, it's very much around evidence of what's worked. So obviously you might have a theory or a hypothesis around this is the way that we can communicate to deliver a desired outcome. But then if you make sure that you measure all of those outcomes all the way through the business outcome and say that worked, right, produced a sale or it's a renewed customer or whatever it is that you're trying to achieve, then you know I need to do more of that in that scenario. That sort of analysis is something that, again, a lot of people overlook. It's much more attractive sometimes to chase the glossy stuff, go and advertise more, go and market more rather than market smarter.
And on top, and with that, we had a chat around data science yesterday with one of our guests and so forth. And obviously in Salesforce, you're going to produce and pull in lots more data. So with your business, are you now helping your clients with analytics and obviously more intelligence or business intelligence, you would call it, more often than not?
We are, and it's becoming a bigger part of what we do. So you know, I guess in the past, what we often would do is say, okay, here's how we can design an experience with you. Here's how you can realize it, and we'll leave it to you to measure it and optimize it. In retrospect, that was a really bad thing to be obviously telling somebody, because that's one of the most important aspects of it. So now more and more we're saying, okay, we need to design it up front such that you'll be able to measure everything that you're doing. And then we'll provide you with and help you build out a framework for measuring and optimizing value. And that sometimes leads to all the way up to optimizing an entire business's value rather than just a value of a product or a marketing campaign or something like that. So we're moving more and more into that area. So some of that stuff, obviously there's much better tools and techniques available to do this sort of thing now. So it's become more accessible, but there's also, you know, a hell of a lot of, let's just say know-how that's required to do this stuff other than at a superficial level. So we've had to ramp up our capabilities around this too.
And actually the reason why I asked the question was skill sets. We just pretty much led onto it. We noticed there's a bit of a, in Australia, that we have some struggles with data skill sets for people coming out of university. While they are getting taught, not necessarily the highest of quality necessarily. Mm-hmm. What's your take on it? What do you see on the market with the right skill sets to help you achieve and analyze your data for different customers?
It's interesting you touched on graduates from university or other education programs and whether we're getting data literacy and that sort of thing as an outcome from education programs. I don't think we are, but I'm not sure that many other jurisdictions do it better, to be perfectly honest. I think it's maybe unrealistic to expect that as well. But what are we saying? We absolutely think that most people who come out, say, as a graduate from a university degree, even if it's focused on data, completely unprepared, basically, to be productive in a business or enterprise environment. So there's a pretty big ramp up. And that's not necessarily around not having some baseline skills. You know, they might know how to navigate their way around a database. They may have some technical skills, SQL skills or a variety of other things. They may even know specific products. And let's imagine you were talking about Azure or AWS or those sorts of platforms. There are actually a lot of products and you can do some really fun things with them. But I don't know how to actually interrogate data. And that's probably the biggest thing. That and sometimes actually going one step back and saying, how do I know what the right question is to ask before I go and interrogate some data to answer it? And if you don't start with that, then you might ask the wrong question. You'll get a really good answer to the wrong question and you still didn't give any value, right? So that's the challenges we have. And my take is that what we do with our guys is we try to build it up from the bottom. So help them answer simple questions first and lead that through the trail of data and interrogate it and interpret data. And then you answer more and more complex questions, hopefully gain more knowledge and experience. And then eventually you'll know all the questions you've got to ask yourself. Takes time though.
With I guess we still got quite a large component of small business in this country, right? And sometimes for say a coffee shop or someone that's a traditional more retail sector, they're starting to go through, I guess, a bit of a transformation themselves especially during COVID, right? Where you had coffee shops that had to sort of evolve to takeaway only, restaurants sort of move to that sort of thing, shifted to items like Uber Eats and Menulog. One of the big areas with that was, I guess those platforms do take quite a large percentage as well. So if I'm looking at, say, for example, of ordering something from Uber Eats, they could take up to 30% to provide that to a restaurant. Yep. So one of the big areas is, Is there still a bit of a barrier at entry for, you know, those traditional businesses to get involved and build a solution for themselves that they can get around some of these bigger competitors? Like, are we at risk of having a bit of a monopoly in certain sectors of our economy by these US giants that have come in and sort of, you know, muscled their way into our market?
I think risk is probably underrating it, because realistically we're already there, right? The challenge we have, and these sort of things are not new. You've got the same thing with social media and a variety of other things. Google is a classic example too. And it's not a challenge that's unique to Australia, by the way, because if you've been following the news, there's been US congressional committees that have actually been investigating whether there is too much monopoly power inside the states as well. So the challenge with all of these things is actually around audiences. So once you capture a pretty large captive audience, then that's actually where all the value lies. So let's imagine that you wanted to, as a small business, go and, you know, transact online, let's put it that way. Then you could do that, and there's very easy to use, pretty much business in a box platforms that will let you do that at a certain level right now. But are you going to attract a significant audience that would come to you directly? Probably not. So hence the reason why everyone's kind of forced or coerced into adopting something like Uber Eats, because they've got the audience already. And if you want access to the customers, that's your conduit to get there. So the only way I think to change that sort of thing would be, you know, for very large portions of that marketplace on the supply side to band together and offer alternatives or support alternatives, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I guess that's another interesting point, right? Is it more around the support? Like, is it, as people, we sort of are conditioned to be lazy and fall into patterns, and the easiest thing, for example, is just to reach to Google rather than, I don't know, Bing, for example, or whatever it might be. But we fall into, I guess, what I would call the tech pattern, where we've kind of narrowed down our favorites and we simply don't see the ramifications of, well, I'm providing all my data to this particular service, ergo, it's going to then become the only real service because I'm not actively using anything else.
I think this is a human trait, of course, right? We specialize in the domain that we're good at, and the other things we kind of follow later a lot of the time. I'm no different, by the way. If I use Google as a search engine, I use Google services to power a lot of our productivity tools. So I'm doing this by default, whether I like it or not. I think, you know, the dilemma you've got is you've got convenience and accessibility and an audience on one side, versus, you know, purity of decision making, let's put it that way, on the other side. And nearly all the time people are going to choose the convenient route. So I think the challenge that's in place, and this is very much a government and regulation challenge, is to recognize when we have monopolies starting to evolve rather than when they already have, and to react. Because right now, and what would it take to pull apart the search engine market and make it competitive again? You pretty much have to slice Google into four businesses or something like this, right, and force them to compete against each other.
Yep, you need something similar to, I guess, to what the Netscape, i.e. antitrust, was back in the day. And even then, that's, I mean, well, you could argue that Microsoft's probably bigger and better than what they were before anyway, but whether that's a direct result. And again, if you're looking at, I guess, there's pretty much the four tech autocrats within the States, and they pretty much wield the power now, not just within inside the States, but I would say globally as well, with the exception of maybe China, would probably be the only one where they don't have any real authority. Although Google has now started to actually shift their service offering to start to become a dominant force in China as well. So that's kind of, I guess, the last market for them to conquer.
Yep. And they're pretty restricted in what they can do over there, because they have to conform, obviously, with the views of the government. Otherwise, they'll be shut out of the services there too. I guess that's the other risk, right? If you don't have a lot of diverse voices, and that has to come from diverse platforms and things like that, then things like freedom of speech, gross manipulation of outcomes, you know, the US election interference is a classic example, all those sort of things become much more feasible and prevalent. So, yeah, there's some pretty big negative side effects that come about with having too much market power and audience concentrated in one spot.
Well, I have to say, you mentioned marketplaces banding together, which was a very key aspect. I did speak to a venture capital firm in Australia a couple of years back, and their comment back to me was Australian startups don't collaborate together. So if we're going to get marketplaces together in Australia, do you think it's a cultural thing to get together and formalize a union, or not a union, but some sort of organization to take on Menulog, for example, or something like that, to get their money back, get and increase their profits and be more sovereign?
It would be valuable. I think the a lot of this stuff actually, if you look at the way things work in the States, there's a lot of this collaboration. I think there's probably multiple drivers that kind of foster it. Some of it is the willingness to fail. So, because people, they'll try again and so forth, they'll end up cross-pollinating. Some of those people land up working with other folks, and then there's a lot more movement, which helps, right? You have movement amongst organizations, then you have a lot more basis for collaboration. The other aspect that's kind of interesting is that, we have, and we talked about this before, right? If you're funded by a bank, then you're not actually connected by that bank with one of your competitors or like-minded businesses as a potential collaborator. That's not a bank's role, but if you're looking at a venture capitalist, they'll absolutely do that, because they want to find a way to magnify and multiply their investment. So we don't have a lot of those middlemen and people who kind of push that collaboration together through the funding vehicles and things like that we have. So we're missing some of that. But there's a mindset thing here too, right? Where we are, again, we've got too many people who sound a bit like you described before, they think we're adopters of technology rather than innovators. So innovation always is accelerated by collaboration.
Absolutely. So maybe it's a case of, a bit more of an open forum, I guess, from technologists sort of coming together from different areas. And I guess we have had that previously, but it's obviously COVID's taken a bit of a knock to that in regards to our current events and thought leaderships and those sort of things too. And I'm not one for digital events, to be honest. I don't find them overly stimulating or massively useful unless it's a singular topic at a shorter period of time. Mm-hmm. But I guess on top of that, so one of the things we were talking about before was Australia is quite innovative. Now, if we have these global giants who really, you're not going to be able to knock them off the perch, right? There's no way you can go and build a search engine tomorrow. Even if the three of us banded together and try to take something on, it's going to be a very, very steep adoption curve.
Yep.
But in regards to building services on top of these monoliths, is that something maybe that Australia could do better at? Maybe providing, alternative services on top of, Google Maps, or utilizing something that Google offers and making it better or more specialized. Is that a trend of innovation that we should be focusing on as opposed to reinventing the wheel, but taking something that's existing and modifying it to make it better to solve a particular problem?
I think there are a lot of businesses doing that already. I guess we should already recognize that, whether it's Google or Amazon or in some cases, clearly Salesforce. There's a big app exchange model that Salesforce has as well. There's a little bit of risk associated with encouraging people to do this, because there's been plenty of stories, obviously, of organizations building a business around that. I mean, to see the vendor themselves, the Googles or whatever, essentially offer a variation of the same thing and buy your way out of it. And you're pretty much offering all of your data, including transactional data and all that sort of stuff, over to them when you build on their platform. And they can see what works and what doesn't work and how it works. So you're exposing yourself a little bit, right? I was just reading today a guy whose case has been quite highly profiled over in the States. He put his inventory of, they were kind of high-end fashion goods, onto Amazon into their warehouse and fulfillment model. And then someone complained about his inventory being inauthentic, and he couldn't resolve that complaint and ended up having all of his inventory destroyed and went bankrupt, basically. So those sorts of things, wielding that market power means that there's a big risk associated with doing that sometimes. So I guess it's great to think that that's a smart thing to do, but you got to be cognizant of what the risks are in doing it as well. I'm not disputing the possibilities, by the way. I think there's big possibilities, and I always advocate building on some top of something rather than reinventing the wheel. You just need to recognize that what's in someone's interest on your side may not be in the same interest on the other side. And the terms in which you use all those services tend to be very heavily weighted in favor of the providers of those platforms. Going to sound like I'm being very negative here, by the way. I think there's a lot of businesses that do a great job of building out services and products on top of.
No, there's definitely something to be wary of, right? So it's not something to go, go ahead, grab it, off you go and run with it. I guess there's two points. One might be the actual provider might shut you down, or two, they can very quickly ramp up an alternative due to the amount of workforce that they have. comparatively to basically just snuff you out as well. So yeah.
Exactly. Cool. And the other factor is you've got to be extra cautious of the intellectual property and the value that you have in your business, because as you put things into a global model and so forth, then theoretically that gets exposed. And if people get hold of that intellectual property, then competing against you is very easy to do, and outside of a jurisdiction that you can do anything about. We've seen this for years, obviously, with counterfeit goods and all those sorts of things, but you'll find very, very rapid and nimble competitors coming out of markets that we have very little jurisdiction over, if any. So that's the other thing. And again, comes back to the concept of innovation, right? If we're not innovating all the time, then people can replicate your model very quickly.
And whether we do or don't innovate further here in Australia, what's a bold prediction for the future for the next 5 to 10 years, next decade?
A little bit hard to make the really short-term predictions, because it's a bit hard to know when this pandemic situation is going to be really in a resolved state versus in what people are affectionately calling the new normal. Post the new normal, what you're going to find is that there's going to be some massive winners, those people that really innovate and push hard at very growth-oriented approaches to doing business, or frankly, not even to be doing business, right, running governments and all those sorts of things, versus people who try to actually conduct business or run organizations, whether they be government or otherwise, the way they were before. You've got to balance that against essentially a lot of pressure to do more with less, which I think you combine those two things together and it's a sweet spot for technology and innovation. So you find a way to make things more efficient, or actually make things not even required anymore because technology and innovation replaces them. Those things are the sweet spots for growing businesses. Where do I think there's going to be a massive change? Well, in the areas that I'm interested in, I do think that those things that we talked about before, Mike, innovative agricultural models, innovative energy models, they'll happen anyway. They just should happen faster, and they should happen in a more Australian-centric way if we were to support them. So we're going to see a big focus on that and a big swathe of integration around that too. The other thing that'll be quite interesting is I think there'll be a bit more risk aversion in places like Australia about spacing large segments of our economy in exposed ways. So things like tourism, education, those sorts of things have been probably irrevocably changed as a result of what we've seen this year. And when they come back, they probably won't look the same. So, a small little example as well. I think I had 13 overseas trips last year. Spent a little over 3.5 months overseas. The chances of me doing that in the next 3 to 5 years are pretty low, probably, because I think people are prioritizing not traveling and not as much interpersonal interaction in person as they had before, which I think is a bad thing. I think the people that still do that will probably end up winning in the end.
Mm. And also maybe have more local travel, local holidays, maybe cheaper, maybe more affordable.
That would be good. Yeah, finding innovative ways to encourage that. So, we've catered for a largely international market who are a little less price conscious, let's face it, than us traveling domestically. Some of this is just kind of a prejudice, I think, that we have, by the way, around, we see something glamorous about going internationally and traveling, where we have tremendous opportunities to travel and experience things locally. So we might be prepared to pay for something larger to go overseas when we wouldn't pay the same thing to do things domestically here. So there's some mindsets and attitude shifts here, but we need to reset it. If you've got something that's pitched at an international audience, and you know that an international audience is probably not going to come back in quite the same volumes in the short term, then you need to change. And I think that'll have lasting effects. And you can see already our education sector, particularly higher education sector, has had to respond to the fact that we can't actually have foreign students land here, not in the same volumes anyway. And they've had to adapt what their offerings are, change their focus to a lot more short courses and something that fosters innovation, that's more business friendly locally here rather than international student friendly. And that will hopefully be a permanent thing, a shift in alignment.
No, definitely, definitely.
It's going to take a while, like.
Oh, very much. I have to ask you one more question on that, actually, if I had to ask you, was the stimulus packages, obviously stimulating the economy through printing money, if you want to call it that way, or borrowing, right? Obviously, that will play a part in the economy. What's your thoughts on that?
I think there's probably two purposes that you should have, at least, behind offering stimulus. One is to obviously provide a buffer, a bit of ballast, so that you don't end up with a deep recession. Clearly, we're going to have a recession, right? We already have. But we have the potential to avoid a really deep one if we provide a little ballast and help businesses and individuals kind of wade their way through. That's one purpose. The other should be actually setting ourselves to rebound in a really strong way. And one of the things that, again, I've kind of been having a lot of conversations around, and I think some of the policy initiatives that have come out clearly haven't actually been a result of my conversations, but I've been having some of the same ones, are around, you know, what are the future needs that we actually have in terms of, you know, people resources, right? So in the area that I'm very familiar with, we've had a lack of technical skill sets and knowledge and data-oriented skill sets in Australia for a long time. Dating myself a little bit here, but back in the late 90s, they were talking about having a massive skills shortage around technology. And it's never gone away. The only way we've been able to address it is to import labor. And we're at this critical juncture right now where we can't import labor into Australia because our borders are all closed. They're probably going to stay closed for quite some time. And you can argue about the suitability of some of the labor, and this is not meant to be criticism of individuals, but suitability of some of the labor in that a lot of the roles that we import are cookie cutter roles. And they help us meet the status quo, you know, the immediate needs of our businesses and industries right now, but they don't actually help us fuel innovation and drive change. So that's the bit where we're not producing that out of our higher education system, certainly not at the volumes we need. We can't import it right now. Even when we were importing it, we weren't really creating the right environments. So we've got a gap. And I think you combine that with the fact that you've got a pretty big swathe of our younger generation that are going to struggle to find their real, you know, first main professional career. We should be directing as many of those that have the creative talents and the right way of thinking towards, you know, future-facing careers. And right now, we don't have anything formal to do that. Have incentives around offering, you know, short courses and things like that. We you know, have the same models that we've always had, albeit we're shifting them a little bit around funding for universities and those sorts of things. But for example, we don't have a robust model to offer the equivalent of an apprenticeship for a professional occupation. So we don't give people a starting point. We don't connect the three parties, the people who provide the training, the employer and the potential employee together in a nicely integrated way to foster that. Make it hard for people, and, you know, some people won't make the effort to get there or won't be able to navigate it to get there.
Good point. Carl and I mentioned this on previous on podcast, but obviously we have apprenticeships for plumbers, electricians, so forth. It's always traditional for that. But now that we are going through stimulus mode, the biggest in 100 years, right? We're going to devalue our dollar further by whatever money. Why don't we just throw it at some more money at the younger generation? If we are, we're going to be in trouble anyway. So I don't know. It's a difficult conversation.
I look at some of this stuff and it seems like a bit of a no-brainer. Admittedly, I'm not the guy who's managing the purse strings on behalf of the government. But if you look at the level of JobKeeper, and if you were to offer that as a subsidy for someone to take a professional apprentice, basically, into a future-facing career track, not all of those will pan out, of course, right? But if you did that, you don't necessarily have to offer it for a really long period of time, but something closer to 12 months rather than 3 or 6 months, then you'd make a massive difference to the willingness of some organisations to take on those roles. That's a pretty big subsidy, right? It probably would equate to about, you know, a little over half of what an entry-level salary is, sometimes more than that. But that's the sort of thing that you probably need to think about as a big gesture if you wanted to shift the dial. To give you an idea, we probably have at any time a shortage of between 30 and 80,000 professionals that we could easily staff in Australia in various forms of future-facing, digitally oriented careers. That's a massive shift, and you're not going to address that through longer term higher education shifts and things like that. You have to address it very, very dramatically now.
Agreed, very direct.
Yeah.
Well, the opportunities now, isn't it? So.
So your point's very valid. You're going to commit tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions, over the lifespan of these stimulus programs.
Yeah.
This is one of the first places I'd be looking.
Yep, I agree. No, it's a good point. No,
the other thing that they, I'm not anti-infrastructure investment, by the way. I think that's a very, very valid thing to do too. But infrastructure programs tend to take in the vicinity of 5 to 10 years to realize major infrastructure investment,
right?
Both in terms of value delivered as well as the expenditure of money.
Yep.
That's great because governments love it. It sits on their book as an asset, and it's something that they can talk about for a long time as a legacy investment and so forth. But if you're looking at immediate and lasting returns, investment in people is going to give you a much higher return.
Yeah, infrastructure and people, right? And I think the people side needs to be thought about there. Yeah. No, it's look, I have to say, once again, it's lovely talking to you. You've got heaps of insights and knowledge on the subject we talked about today and plenty of information. I think we'll have to have you back on, eh, Carl? Be rude not to.
I think so. It's definitely always wonderful talking to you, Peter. And thank you very much for coming on board and having a chat with us today.
Absolute pleasure. Very happy to come on again. And really appreciate the opportunity to have a bit of a chat with you guys anytime.
Thank you. Pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Wonderful. Thanks, Peter. Cheers.
Yeah.